From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in Rochester this week in the year 1872 when suffragist Susan B. Anthony and a group of women broke the law. Anthony and her fellow suffragists cast their ballots for president just days after Anthony convinced elections inspectors to register them. The move made national news, sort of. The next morning, the New York Times ran the story under the headline, Minor Topics. It was a short paragraph that said in part, quote, "We have heard before of solitary instances of the recognition of the female franchise, but this picket guard of nine is a tangible enough force to make people reflect on the future possibilities which it involves. The fact is not stated, but we may assume with tolerable certainty that the nine ladies at Rochester showed their capacity for an intelligent exercise of the franchise by voting for Grant and Dix," end quote. Well, 2 weeks later, Anthony was arrested. In June 1873, she went on trial in Canandaigua, where Circuit Justice Ward Hunt handed down a guilty verdict. He fined Anthony $100, which she refused to pay. She told him, quote, "I shall never pay a dollar of your unjust penalty." And she never did. Susan B. Anthony is buried in Mount Hope Cemetery, and on many election days, voters place their "I voted" stickers on her grave. On this election day, 146 years after she made that illegal vote, we re-examine that moment in history and ask what lessons we can learn. And by the way, what would Susan B. Anthony say to people planning not to vote today? I'd like to welcome our guests for the hour. Deborah Hughes is Executive Director of the Susan B. Anthony House and Museum. Always nice to have you, Deborah. Deborah, thanks for being back here.
Great to be here, Evan.
And also with us is Autumn Haig, a Special Collections Librarian and Archivist for Research and Collections at the University of Rochester River Campus Libraries. Autumn, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Listeners, throughout the program today, especially as we go through our second half hour, if you want to share your stories, have you visited Susan B. Anthony's grave? I know a lot of people remember 2 years ago and hundreds, of course, on that day, and understandably so. But if you've been out there today, if you want to share your thoughts or just share your thoughts about the legacy and the history of Susan B. Anthony, you can call or email the program and we'll get to some of your feedback in our second half hour. But Deborah, I admit, I wanted to do the story, as I said in the intro, kind of selfishly, because I knew the story of her voting and then getting arrested, but not really. I mean, not some of the details. I didn't know if she did it alone. I didn't know if she did it as part of a group. I didn't know if she did it really ostentatiously or sort of quietly. So why don't you kind of take us through what led up to that in 1872?
Right. Well, after the passage of the 14th Amendment, which said that anyone who was born here, it's the birth right amendment, was a citizen. The women said, oh my goodness, look at that. Based on that new constitutional amendment, we are citizens, and clearly our right of a citizen is to vote, so we may already have it. And so Susan B. Anthony was the most famous case, but there were women all across the country who were attempting to register and vote. There were about 50 in Rochester who actually registered, and then the story is 14 women with Susan B. Anthony, or 15, depending on which story you read. It's a dramatic story. Susan B. Anthony's sister, Guelma, who was suffering from tuberculosis, is said to have gotten up out of her deathbed to march down the street to vote. One of my favorite characters, Rhoda DeGarmo, who was in her late 70s, who was the woman who lived in the farm next door to the Anthonys and had a documented Underground Railroad site, was one of those who came out to vote that day. She died about 6 months later. They were trying to test this new constitutional amendment and to demonstrate that as citizens, they already had that right and ability to vote.
A logical assumption, right?
Well, it was, although the U.S. Constitution had always said that it was states who set the barrier or who lowered the barrier for people to vote. And so this was a real test following the Civil War about what kind of nation were we going to be.
I also know that, our listeners may have the assumption that, so she votes, she gets arrested, she gets hauled off. That's not how it happened.
No, and there's an awful meme that circulates out on the internet that shows a woman who's being beaten and dragged off to jail, and it's actually a British suffragette quite a few years later.
Not only is that meme confusing, I've heard some local journalists had invoked it thinking it might have been real. So let's just state this again. I think the woman's like on the ground in the street or something. Is that right?
Correct.
Okay, that is not Susan B. Anthony. If you see that picture shared, she did not get arrested that day in 1872.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct.
So what happened?
So a couple weeks after she voted, there comes a knock on the front door. And this is a little bit of the oral tradition. And it's a U.S. Marshal saying, I have a warrant for your arrest, Miss Anthony. And she wanted to be, put me in handcuffs and take me out. And he said, really, you could just report downtown. But she wanted to be treated as any male person being arrested would have been treated. He takes her out in the story, which is a little hyperbole, we suspect, is they got out to the horse-drawn trolley on West Main Street, and when the conductor asked for the fare, she said, "I'm in the custody of the United States government. He will pay my fare." And so now word was out. Susan B. Anthony had been arrested.
Now, Ann Gordon has written and said that Susan B. Anthony, perhaps leading up to November 5th, 1872, did not expect to really be allowed to vote, even though, you know, she could get registered. She didn't think that she could. Then she ends up voting and wasn't sure she would even be arrested afterward because she wasn't arrested on the spot either. So I know there was some confusion about what really is going to happen here.
Correct. Well, they're testing a new constitutional amendment. And she was able to convince two of the three registrars that they could register and vote.
They didn't, like, you know, text their bosses, you know, or call somebody or, you know, look it up on, you know, Google, am I allowed to do this?
Well, and one of them was opposed.
Right.
And all three of them ended up going to jail for having let these women register to vote.
Exactly. I'm just surprised in retrospect that two out of the three said yes. But again, this is part of my ignorance of history. I don't know, did they have to clear it with anybody else, or did they say, okay, you made a good argument. Yeah, you're registered.
I don't think they cleared it with anyone else. I think they just
Isn't that wild?
Conferred, yeah.
Isn't that wild? So they end up being able to vote. She ends up saying, okay, arrest me the same way. And then her trial isn't until what, the next year, right?
Correct, until June of the next year.
June of the next year. And another, you know, interesting twist was that she ends up getting, what, a $100 fine?
Correct.
A $100 fine for voting, and announces she will never pay it. No, but then the judge has to sort of decide, well, if we just let this thing drop, then it drops here. Otherwise, she can take this to a higher court. Is that correct?
Correct. That was
so. There's a lot of strategy involved here.
There is a lot of strategy. She's really trying to test the law. She felt that the trial was a miscarriage of justice because the judge had directed the jury how they would vote. He didn't have the jury discuss the verdict. And so she felt she was entitled to a jury of her peers. And she was quick to point out she didn't have peers since she allowed them to be sovereigns over her since they had a vote. And then they didn't even get to discuss it. So she felt it was, as she said, the greatest miscarriage of justice.
Well, I'd like to at least read a little bit. And I was hoping that Barbara Blaisdell, who does such a great job portraying Susan B. Anthony, who couldn't be with us today because I think of an illness. But Barbara, if you're listening, we always appreciate your work. I was going to ask her to read this, but I guess I'll just read, you know, some of the really famous lines here, because somebody's got to read these. After the justice ruled Susan B. Anthony guilty, he asked her if she had anything to say. She said, and this is considered, again, by many, in my understanding, perhaps the most famous speech in the history of the agitation for women's suffrage. Is that right, what she said following?
Well, her Failure's Impossible speech is pretty famous.
Okay, all right. So this is up there. Okay, I'm going to read what she said. Quote, "Yes, Your Honor, I have many things to say. For in your ordered verdict of guilty, you have trampled underfoot every vital principle of our government. My natural rights, my civil rights, my political rights, my judicial rights, all alike ignored. Robbed of the fundamental privilege of citizenship, I am degraded from the status of a citizen to that of a subject. And not only subject, and not only myself individually, but all of my sex are, by Your Honor's verdict, doomed to political subjection under this so-called form of government." End quote. She was good. She knew how to grab a moment, I think.
Indeed she did.
So now here we are, in a very different world. And before we kind of get into more of the history, and I know that Autumn has a lot to share with us just about the words of Susan B. Anthony and the remarkable letters we still have that survive that sort of inform us about ideas and strategy and so much. I wonder how both of you feel on election days. We all know people who aren't voting. It's their choice not to vote. Some are not even registered. Some are registered and will not vote. How do you feel about that, Deborah?
Democracy only works if people vote. Susan B. Anthony wrestled with Matilda Joslyn Gage and some of the other women in the movement about who would we let to vote. And she really believed until you could hear the voice of everyone, you couldn't put together good government. She frequently referenced the Declaration of Independence. You know, the governed get their privilege of governing because they're elected by the people who are part of the system. She understood how complicated it would be to govern and to select laws that took care of the people, and believed in that, believed we had to have an educated populace, but passionately believe that people had to have a voice and a vote if we were going to make the thing work.
So are you disappointed when people tell you, nah, I didn't get around to voting?
I'm disappointed when people say, I didn't vote because I don't think the system is for me. And I'm disappointed when people say, you know, the people that are elected aren't serving me because they abdicate and they let all of the other voices then control their lives.
Well, you know, on that argument, we heard from, and I don't want to say this sort of demeaningly by age. I was going to say a young black woman, young as in defined by the sort of voter blocks under the age of 30. So a woman in her 20s, she's an African American, who says, we have a country built on white supremacy. Participating in this system only seems to affirm that power structure, and I'm not going to do it. And man, as a white man, I have no way to relate to that, and I respect that concern that she has. What I hear you saying is you encounter people saying, you know, look, the system doesn't work, or I don't think it works. The concern is if you only wait to participate in voting once the system has changed, will it ever change? Can you only do it incrementally from within? Or is there an argument to say, I'm sitting out until true equality is achieved? What do you think?
I think that's the great challenge of democracy, because most of the great changes that have happened are when we hear the minority voice. It's when you can convince other people that the right thing to do or the conscionable thing to do is to empower other people. And if you stay out of it, then we don't change. And we run a risk of becoming less and less of a representative democracy if people don't participate.
Hmm. Autumn, how do you feel about people not participating?
I think I feel most disappointed when people say that their vote doesn't matter somehow because they're one person. They feel like the numbers are sort of overwhelmingly against them. So I do find that frustrating, and especially thinking about the abolition movement, the suffrage movement, and how long it took for change to come about. And I think you just have to have the patience and the optimism to keep working, keep voting about issues that are important to you.
I want to read a little from, I mentioned the New York Times covering Susan B. Anthony. And again, how many women voted with Susan B. Anthony? How many total women?
15 total.
15 total. November 5th, 1872, in the presidential election. And as we mentioned, the New York Times covered it under minor topics, but do you want to see what misogyny looks like in print? I mean, it's just amazing stuff that was written about not only that event, but the subject of, well, should women be given the vote? An article published. So the Times covers minor topics, et cetera, as we said. And then in the ensuing years, obviously the New York Times covered protest movements, the notion of women's suffrage. And in the ensuing years, just the way the Times published commentary or analysis was shocking in retrospect. This is from October 16th, 1882, an article written in terms that would obviously be deemed unquestionably sexist today, but here it is. I'm going to quote from it. Quote, literal people may ask, why then does not woman have the right of suffrage? The answer is easy. She does not want it. Of course, it must be admitted that women, or some women, think they want the ballot, but they do not really want it. Philosophers have observed that the female desire is invariably kindled by that which is or seems to be unattainable. End quote. Deborah, is it good to know that you don't actually know what you want and that men will explain to you what you really want? Is that helpful?
It gets me out to vote, Evan.
Yeah, it does get you out to vote. But no, I'm here to help. You see that you don't really want to vote. You think you want it because you can't have it.
Right.
Is that amazing that this is the New York Times in 1882? It probably shouldn't amaze us.
Well, the amazing thing is that there were women who were anti-suffragists who were saying that same thing.
That does really amaze me, because I'm not surprised looking back at the sexism. Like, I hate to say it, but there's plenty of men today I can see actually writing those words and meaning it. That's the world we live in. But women? I mean, Autumn, what is it like reading, sometimes going back to see the debate about suffrage and seeing the anti-suffragists who were women?
Yeah, I mean, they There were a lot of them. They produced a lot of editorials, pamphlets, books. What I find most interesting is that both the suffragists and the anti-suffragists use the idea of sort of the woman at home as their main theme. So for suffragists, if you're going to be a good mother, you need to be able to vote in ways that will support your husband and family. If you're an anti-suffragist, if you vote, then, women are going to turn into men. The world is going to run amok. The whole sort of family order will be turned upside down. So they're using a lot of the same sort of images and themes, but coming at them from very different points of view.
Yeah, the New York Times published a separate piece arguing that suffrage for women would bring desolation and distraction into multitudes of happy homes. So what do you, are those among your favorite sort of scare tactics against suffrage, that the distinction between women and men would be blurred, we'd lose what it means to be a woman and a man if we just let women vote? Is that, are there others that stand out to you?
Well, there's a great sort of caricature of Susan B. Anthony that came out, I think, right before the trial. And so it's a picture of her in front, but in the background you have a female police officer, and then you have a man holding a baby. And I love that those are the two things that they wanted to highlight, that you have this very sort of, at the time, very masculine occupation, and heavens, a woman is doing it, and then a man holding a baby, which should be a totally normal thing, but is, the sign of the social order collapsing. Hmm.
Deborah?
When I think about it, if we were having this discussion 4 years ago, before the 2016 election, I would have thought we'd be having a discussion about history. But to me, we're not having a discussion about history. We're having a discussion about exactly what we're wrestling with in this country today. The whole idea of how do we want to be a country? Who do we want to have participate in the decisions? And we're seeing the same kind of strategies that were being exercised in the 19th century. If I think that you will vote for my cause, then I want to empower you to vote. If I think that you might vote for the other cause or the other purpose, then I'm going to do everything that I can to keep you away from the ballot box. I'm going to confuse you. I might make you re-register. I might change how you show your voter ID. I might alter the whole system, because in this country, because of our Constitution, the most powerful thing that we have is the vote. But we could lose it. We could lose it at any point if we elected people who began to diminish the powers and the rights that we as individuals have.
Hmm. Listeners, as we go throughout this program, I want to hear your thoughts on the legacy of Susan B. Anthony, especially on Election Day, what it means to you as a voter, what you think it means to this country. It's 844-295-TALK. That's toll-free, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. Producer Megan Mack points out that in the New York Times reporting on Susan B. Anthony's vote, her illicit vote in 1872, even that article referenced, quote, a little band of nine ladies, again thought to be nine at the time. Deborah has said it's about 15 who voted. A little band of nine ladies. Does that language, even that language to you, seek to diminish, do you think?
Sure. That's one of the debates we have about suffragette, which was the word that the British women chose after the turn of the century, and suffragist, which Susan B. Anthony and Frederick Douglass preferred. Any attempt to diminish these women, make them insignificant, less threatening, less important. We can't imagine how difficult it was for those early pioneers in terms of the social consequences of standing up for a woman's right to vote, crossing gender lines. I mean, this was, they had hurled at them every accusation. They were going to destroy civilization completely. They were going to ruin democracy. And I can't imagine what courage it took to be so persistent over 70 years to try to change the hearts of others.
Yeah. So, Autumn, I remember a conversation earlier this year, this past summer on Connections, where it was referenced that there were Harvard doctors in the late 19th century who wrote about how, women's brains were different. Women were incapable of sort of the same intellectual rigor as men, and that was just science. I mean, these were not sort of fringy cable news types. I mean, these are some leading figures warning, look, I mean, men have to be entrusted with important duties here. Women have their role, but do you want to trust them with the vote? I mean, why would you do that? And those are not, again, those were leading lights.
No.
And so in some sense, do you feel like boy, we've come a remarkably long way? Or do you instead feel in 2018, I can't believe some of the conversations we still have?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like, you know, maybe science isn't being used in the same way, but I still feel like, that we have a long way to go in terms of encouraging everyone to vote. I mean, I feel lucky in New York, for example, with the hours that the polls are open here, which, you know, is a pretty substantial amount of time compared to other states. And so certainly I think it's logistically, if you're working, if you have kids, it can still be difficult to vote in some places. So, yeah, I think there's still a lot of work to be done.
Do you feel, how do you feel, Deborah?
Yeah, I feel we were progressing, but it's fragile. Democracy is fragile. I think that's a reality. And I think that's what's both hopeful and exciting about it and disturbing.
I'm not laughing at the notion of it being fragile at all. The word disturbing had sort of a dark twist at the end of that sentence. That's why I didn't mean to laugh at that, Deborah. Let me read a couple of emails that have come in. Kat says, how quickly we forget that only 2 years ago, GOP women proclaimed that they would gladly give up their right to vote if it meant Donald Trump would be president. Seen across social media platforms, scary stuff. That's from Kat. And again, I appreciate that, Kat, but I mean, you know, we want to open up the phones and the emails. It's not intended to be an overly political hour. In fact, on Election Day, we really seek not to be overtly political. It's an important day to let people make their own decisions and sort of kind of clear their heads a little bit. It's an emotional, difficult day for a lot of people. But again, we'll take more of your emails and calls. Kay writes to us and says, why was her trial held in Canandaigua? And can you tell us more about the three registrars who went to jail?
So it was moved to Canandaigua deliberately because after Susan B. Anthony was arrested, she went on a speaking tour of Monroe County. We have a letter in our collections where she writes, "We must get the men of Rochester so enlightened that no jury of 12 men can be found to convict us." And so what they did was they moved it so that the men of Rochester would not be on the jury. It would be men in Ontario County.
It wasn't a change of venue like we think of now, but it was circuit court. Hmm. So by scheduling it on the docket at a time that it would be when the judge would be in Canandaigua.
Okay. And she's curious about the three registrars. Do we know much about them?
We do. We know quite a bit about them. One of the interesting things is they were all pardoned by President Grant later. Susan B. Anthony didn't want to be pardoned, even though Judge Van Voorhis went to fight that case for her. When they went to jail, the local suffragists organized meals and took them to jail. I think prison was a different kind of situation in the 19th century, and reached out to them. And so we have their names. We know all of their circumstance, and they suffered the consequences of having allowed this to happen.
Okay,
including the one who voted against allowing the women to vote. So he was jailed as well, even though he had not sort of furthered their cause.
Okay, I'm curious to know why he would have been jailed.
Well, the decision was in letting them register. So he lost the decision, and then when they showed up to vote, because they were legitimately registered.
I see.
Yeah.
I see. So so the notion being, you tried to stop them from registering, which you should have done, but then when they showed up and to vote, you didn't prevent them from voting. Okay.
I think that's it, yeah.
Okay. Before we get our only break of the hour, let me just touch on one more important point here, because again, this is not a political statement, but I think it's a wise and important one from Deborah, and I want to put a finer point on it. When you talk about democracy being fragile, when you talk about rights and movements toward perceived equality as being fragile, certainly there are many people who would agree with you, and there are some who would say, look, you know, we're not perfect, but we're not denying women the right to vote. We're not talking about how science says women have smaller brains or incapable of processing information. We don't do that anymore. And progress is maybe not as fast as you like, but why is it still sky is falling? So give me a sense for why you feel like it's important to always keep in our mind the fragility of either progress or equality or democracy, and what you think the risk is if we sort of take it for granted.
Well, I think the discussions about the 14th Amendment, this is the amendment that got Susan B. Anthony out to vote that year, and it's probably our most controversial amendment. It's the one that, on the basis of that, I have the right to be married to my spouse, a woman. It's the amendment on which Roe versus Wade decision was based. It's the amendment that overturned a lot of the civil rights decisions. And when we, even when we start to have a conversation about changing the birth citizenship,
birthright citizenship,
that's to me,
that's right.
That's that might be code for let's reverse the 14th Amendment and all that's in it. And there's so much in the 14th Amendment that is important to me as a woman, as a lesbian, as a citizen in this country, critically important to civil rights for groups of people with whom I don't identify, but who have been protected because of our interpretation of that amendment. And that's the example for me. If you overturn an amendment in the Constitution, or if you have a movement to change it, things can change pretty significantly. One of the things about the 14th Amendment was in the Minor versus Happersett case, which happened, Minor voted at the same time as Susan B. Anthony did. And by the time the case got to the Supreme Court ruled that, in fact, voting is not a right that's guaranteed by the Constitution, voting is not a right that's guaranteed by being a citizen. And that decision, that interpretation, which said states still get to set that bar, is what prevented Native Americans from voting in 1924, when we finally said that any Native American who was born here is also a citizen, because they weren't included in the 14th Amendment. They were specifically excluded from the 14th Amendment. Even then, states could continue to prevent them from registering to vote on that basis of the idea that citizenship doesn't mean you get the right to vote.
Hmm. Autumn, do you agree that we should always be sort of on guard for how fragile democracy can be?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
I want to get our only break of the hour, and I want to tell our listeners again, we'll take more of your emails if you like. And we had a listener email the program that I think Autumn and Deborah can address, which was, to the extent that there were women who were against the suffrage movement, what was the actual turnout of women in 1920? So more of a history lesson, how many women actually voted come 1920? Of course, after the passing of Susan B. Anthony, but did you have a lot of women sort of sitting out on purpose then? So we'll talk a little bit about more of the history lesson there. And I want to talk more about what we find in the letters. And that's something that I think Autumn Haig can help enlighten us with this remarkable collection. She is a special collections librarian and archivist for research and collections at the University of Rochester River Campus Libraries. Deborah Hughes, executive director of the Susan B. Anthony House and Museum. Here in Rochester, it's election day. A lot of people already out there at Susan B. Anthony's grave. And by the way, Frederick Douglass as well, putting stickers. I voted, and important to do that, acknowledging our history. You want to call the program and share your story? You can do that at 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. You can email us, connections@WXXI.org. It was 146 years old yesterday that Susan B. Anthony was able to vote in 1872 and then subsequently arrested for doing so. It's history, it's democracy, and much more on Connections on this election day. Coming up in our second hour, we sit down with Ambassador Earl Anthony Wayne. He's a former ambassador to Mexico. He's in Rochester as a guest of the local chapter of the World Affairs Council. He will talk to us about the Honduran caravan that's on its way to the U.S. southern border. We're also going to talk about the new NAFTA and trade relations with Mexico, understanding all of those complex issues as best we can with Ambassador Wayne next hour. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Back to your emails in a moment here, but Autumn Haig from the University of Rochester's River Campus Libraries has a couple of letters subsequent to the vote by Susan B. Anthony in 1872. Susan B. Anthony and 14 women voting in Rochester after registering, citing the 14th Amendment, getting registered, going out, voting. And you got a couple of letters. Tell us about these.
So the first letter is from November 12th, so just a few days after she voted. And we don't know who she's writing it to. It's addressed to my dear young friend. So my guess is that it's a young woman in Rochester. But I just love the first sentence of the letter. Yes, you shall have the autograph of the first woman who legally registered and voted in the state of New York under the 14th Amendment. So I'm guessing she got a little fan letter, someone who really appreciated, admired her efforts to vote, and she is sending them just a little note back, sort of a memento. And then our second letter, I had quoted from earlier in the show, where she's talking about getting the men of Rochester to vote again, or to vote in favor of her during the trial. And so I just love that it shows it's from January of 1873 to one of her lawyers. And the letter is full of strategy, getting her speeches into local papers, talking about the judge, and then this strategy for going on the speaking tour and convincing the men of Rochester to support her.
Mm. How much, Deborah, do we, and I think I've probably asked you this before, but I always like to know, how much do we have of the letters and her archive survived versus not survived? Historical figures of the time, of course, there are some, we've got a remarkable sort of treasure chest of letters, and then others we don't have as much. How do we do with Susan B. Anthony?
We do quite well with Susan B. Anthony. She was prolific, and she was famous even while she was alive, and so people kept their copies of her letters. She infamously burned her copies of her letters after she worked with Ida Husted Harper to write her biography.
Do we know why, by the way?
Well, in the biography, the work was done. It's a great debate. If we talk to our friend Sally Rush Wagner at the Matilda Joslyn Gage Foundation, she suggests that they were burning information about Matilda Joslyn Gage and writing others out of history. I suspect it's more likely that there were personal references in the letters, and she had elected to put into the history that she had, and she was destroying the other conversations. I know the recent collection of letters that the University of Rochester acquired, which are from Isabella Hooker, have some really interesting and pretty clearly personal sides of Susan B. Anthony we hadn't seen before.
What's an example?
Elizabeth Cady Stanton has gotten engaged in the whole controversy about the affair, and Anthony's talking about how she doesn't want to be subpoenaed and have to talk about that. And her language is a little bit more flamboyant than usual. And also it's just really a personal letter. Most of, you know, she was a public persona, and she kept three stenographers busy full time generating letters. So there's thousands of them out there. Fortunately, there are collections at several different places around the country, and we all jointly had those microfilmed and published. The Library of Congress has just digitized and released their copies of everything. So you can read her diaries, you can read letters that they have, and things are still being discovered. People find, you know, shoeboxes in their attics.
Now that's the amazing thing. Is that always the dream, Autumn, when you get that kind of a phone call?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. These were letters that were found in a box in a barn in Connecticut. They had been there for over 100 years.
Yeah.
So, yeah. And anyone who's interested in taking a look in them can come by our department at the University of Rochester and take a look.
The physical copies?
Yeah.
I mean, I suspect you can't let the public touch the physical copies.
No, we're open to the public. If you want to come in and take a look at these letters, you can come in and register as a researcher and sit in our reading room and look at them.
Okay, that is a great idea. Where are you? Tell the public how to do that if they want to do that. That's a great resource.
So we're the Department of Rare Books, Special Collections and Preservation, and we're in Rushree's Library at the University of Rochester, so on the main campus.
All right. Great opportunity to do that. Autumn Haig is Special Collections Librarian there, and Deborah Hughes, Executive Director of the Susan B. Anthony House and Museum. A lot of emails coming in, some a little more politically tinged, some less so. Let me read. This is from Dennis, who says, regarding the comment that we still see today the same kinds of resistance to women's rights as we did back in, 1872, there were two women dressed as 19th century suffragists at the Women's March in Seneca Falls in January 2017, holding my favorite signs of the march. Same stuff, different century. Though Dennis says they may not have used the word stuff. They might have used a different word, a less radio-friendly word. Same stuff, different century. It's not exactly the same stuff, but is that funny to you? Do you agree with Dennis? That's a good sign.
Well, I think we laugh because there's truth in it.
Yeah.
I think the women were, the early 19th century in New York State, a woman who was married was not recognized by the law. She couldn't own property. She couldn't sign a contract. And it's hard for us to imagine what that would have been like, you know, if you were trapped in domestic violence. You couldn't leave. They were his children. You couldn't take them with you. And so when we read reporters later in the century saying, we can't let these people vote, they're not capable, they're not competent, it's very hard for us to imagine a time when a woman was not considered to be a human being who could function with an executive brain. But that's the reality just 150 years ago.
Let me read an email from Teresa. And Teresa, in the spirit of Election Day and our desire not to be overly politicized on the program, I'm going to edit a little bit. So if you're listening, that's the only reason why. She does write, Evan, the women who were against suffrage were mind-boggling to me. She compares them to modern analogs, and I'm not going to read the rest of the email. But I will say Teresa finds women of the decades of Susan B. Anthony's life leading up to not only her passing, but then 1918, 1920. She finds it mind-boggling that there were women who were against suffrage. So let's just talk a little bit more about that. Do you look back, and you both have read a lot in their own words of the debates of the time. Does any of it make sense to you? I mean, is it sort of socialized into the culture? I mean, what do you make of that, Deborah?
I think it makes huge sense. Whenever people are adamant about change, there's usually a fear element to that. And it was easy to tap into that fear piece. If women vote, it's going to upset everything about the balance of society. By the time we get to 1920, where women have had a certain amount of freedom during World War I, and have begun to exercise some more leadership, people were afraid of the socialist trend. If we give women the right to vote, we're going to end up having a revolution like they've had in Russia. If we give women the right to vote, they'll make decisions. They'll change my life in ways that I don't anticipate because they're essentially different from anything we've had working before. And so people would just tap into that. What was your greatest fear? To say to white women, if we give women the right to vote, black women will get to vote as all. Tap into the racism there. Isn't it better to keep your status in society now than to maybe throw that upside down by empowering other people?
So they used a lot of different tactics.
Yeah, whatever tactic would work. They would figure, which is, right, this is politics, figure out where people will get afraid. Susan B. Anthony really believed in the importance of a free press, felt that that was key to democracy. That was one of the reasons that she started her own magazine with Elizabeth Cady Stanton, and believed if we didn't have good public education where we could teach people how to have discernment and to understand democracy, and if we didn't have a free press, democracy doesn't work.
Hmm. Anything you want to add there, Autumn, just in terms of thoughts on women at the time who opposed suffrage?
I mean, I don't think most American children at the time were raised in households that supported suffrage. Mm-hmm. And so it was not always a mainstream belief. And I think that, you know, children absorb what their parents believe, what their friends at school are talking about, what they read in mainstream papers. And so I guess it doesn't surprise me because suffrage was not always a mainstream movement.
We had a question from a listener about how many women did and did not vote after 1920, and producer Megan Mack had it in our notes initially. November 2nd, 1920, more than 8 million American women voted. But the question of how many women chose not to vote for whatever reason, Megan writes, and I think wisely so, that is not an easy question to answer because, first of all, states ratified amendments at different times. Some women, as we just mentioned, women of color were not considered citizens, did not have the same rights at different times in different places. So the notion of just putting a hard number on how many women sort of sat it out in 1920, we don't know. But, you know, Deborah, 1920, 8 million American women voted. And what do you think? I guess I want to ask both of you just in terms of understanding history. If the fear was, if you do this, we're going to lose households, women and men are going to blur the distinction, children will suffer, we'll have revolution. How quickly did we get over that? You know, 1920 comes and goes and, you know, turns out women are more than capable of voting and without, you know, sort of having a brain hemorrhage and the world doesn't end. But how quickly do you think the society got over that?
We have not passed the Equal Rights Amendment yet.
So you're about to say we have not gotten over that.
Yeah, I think that that's true. I mean, we still like to pick on groups that we think are a threat to us. Some of the anti-suffragists were concerned if you empowered these immigrant women, how would they vote? You know, at that time they were Irish and Scotch, and or if you empowered these Catholic women, how would they vote? I mean, it's that whole where people are more comfortable where they are, and if you can convince them, things will change if you let these people be a part of the system. It triggers that anxiety and that fear. We still play that game. That's what fascinates me, that, deciding are we a what kind of country do we want to be? I think that's Susan B. Anthony had some great discussions with Matilda Joslyn Gage. Gage, who was concerned that if the National American Woman Suffrage Association aligned themselves with the temperance movement, that there were some evangelical Christian women who really wanted Jesus to be the God in whom we trust and would propose a constitutional amendment to that end. And Gage thought that that would be the end of freedom of religion. And Anthony says, no, we've got room on the platform for everyone. And she lists, Anglicans and Mohammedans, which would have been the phrase for Muslims at the time, and Baptists and even atheists. And it's that statement that if you bring everybody to the table, yes, it's complicated. And I'm smiling because I think it's also fun. The number of times that I come into a room and someone who comes from a different place than I do has an opinion where suddenly I realize, oh, I didn't have enough information to make a good decision, or what I thought was a really good direction actually is flawed. And in the business world, we know that in companies where we bring diversity to the table, there's more creativity, there's more effective production. The business world really gets that you want to have everybody there because you're better when you have everybody around the table.
So when you say it's fun, encountering new perspective, absorbing new ideas.
Yeah, because if the game is that we want society to succeed, that we want people to live better lives that are fuller, richer, then there's a certain amount of joy in trying to get it right, trying to work together to figure it out, to say, oh, yeah.
Boy, that's so true. And it's one thing my poor six-year-old hears from me all the time, but I try to just kind of like grind it into him. If you are wrong, it's okay. And it's okay to say it. It's okay to say, I don't know. And it's exciting because it means you get to learn something new. When your mind changes, when you have a new opinion, that means that you encountered new things of the world. We don't possibly have the monopoly on information and perspective. So I think that's very well taken. Really important stuff. Let me read a couple of other emails. They keep coming in this morning. A lot of people sharing their stories having been out voting, thinking about Susan B. Anthony. Here's Charlotte and Pen Yan, listening on Finger Lakes Public Radio, WEOS. Thanks to the wonderful colleagues we have down at WEOS, and thank you for listening in Pen Yan. Charlotte, she says, I just wanted to share that my paternal grandmother probably was one of those first women voters. She went on to become a Republican committee man, is what it was called, a committee man in the 1930s, getting people to sign petitions, taking my dad along when he was a little boy. This was in a county township outside Fulton, New York. Her example inspired my dad to do the same, and her legacy of voting has continued down through the generations. As my son voted downstate at 6:45 this morning, my daughter and husband took their 5 and 8-year-olds and voted at 7:15 a.m. in Palmyra. My husband and I just voted and always vote in primaries as well, because my dad told me that way you can vote twice for someone. So that's from Charlotte and Pen Yan. First of all, it's a great story, Charlotte. Thank you for the family story. And I always appreciate it when people are pushing us to remember the primaries, because a lot of power to vote on Election Day, but sometimes even more power in the primaries when a lot fewer of us vote. So thank you for that, Charlotte. Great story. I don't think I have time to get to them all. I'm going to keep reading stories here. Dawn says, hello, Evan. My husband and I voted early this morning and brought our 3 young daughters with us, as we did 2 years ago. We talked with the girls about the importance of voting and the significance of being an informed, active participant in our democracy. And after we voted at the polls, we walked in the rain to place our I voted stickers on Susan B. Anthony's grave, where we talked more about the seriousness of always using your vote as your voice, especially as women. My oldest girl, 7 years old, then asked me if it really mattered. And when I asked why she would ask, she said, well, after the last time we did this, you were so sad because you didn't get what you wanted. Through gritted teeth, I said, but I counted. And to not be counted is far worse than not even trying. I know she was listening, but I hope she heard me. That's from Dawn. That's a powerful story. Thank you, Dawn. What do you guys think of that?
Oh yeah, that's wonderful. To be encouraging your children to vote, to have grit and resilience, and yeah, that your vote counts even if you don't, you know, get your way. I think, you know, I don't think anybody's ever voted for winners the whole way through. But to, yeah, to have the message to the children be that it still matters, it still counts. It's wonderful.
I think I may have seen that very family coming down the cobblestone road as we were walking up to put our stickers up there. I think that's, you may think about Susan B. Anthony, all of the state initiatives that she campaigned for and worked for, and she died before women got the right to vote. So to spend more than half of a century going into elections and sometimes gaining more, but losing and losing and losing. She didn't see the 19th Amendment pass. And I love that at one point when a reporter asked her, how do you handle all that defeat? And she said, defeats? There have been none. We're always making progress.
Powerful stuff. And, you know, that's a really good lesson, by the way, that Dawn shared about talking to children. I mean, if you're going to take your children to the polls, I hope you're explaining to them that elections do not always go as you would like them, and that the work is, number one, I always tell my son, I always hope that the person I didn't vote for, if they win, I hope that I was wrong about them. I hope that they are nicer and governed better than I expected. And if not, we got another chance coming up here. And there's always a chance, and you always are constructive. So better than sitting out anyway, or at least feeling, as Dawn said, like she counted. And that matters. And you think about the centuries we've had in which people have not been allowed to count. Christy wants to know, she says, I wonder as I listen about any connections you can make between the suffragist movement, the legitimacy of the vote, and the legitimacy of protest. How are these points related or in tension? From Christy. Deborah?
Well, I think the Susan B. Anthony encouraged civil disobedience if there was an unjust law. The Fugitive Slave Act of 1850 was one that she felt every citizen should violate and not participate in. But she also believed that the vote was the way to really to change the laws and make it possible for us to be in a different place.
So we get ready to wrap the hour here in a couple of minutes. I just want our guests one more time to tell you where you can learn more about Susan B. Anthony. And I love what Autumn Haig told us earlier. So tell us again, you want to go and you want to read those letters. You want to see what they look like. You want to have a chance to experience that. You can do that. Where can you do that?
Absolutely. At the University of Rochester, Rush Rees Library. It's the beautiful building with the dome on the center of campus. And we're the Department of Rare Books, Special Collections, and Preservation. We're up on the second floor. We have a lot of these letters up online, too. But if you want to come in and take a look at them, you're welcome to.
Do you need to make an appointment? I mean, you just show up and be like, hey, give me the Susan B. Anthony letter.
If you make an appointment, we can do a little bit of legwork for you in advance, but nope, you don't have to have one. You can show up. We're open Monday to Friday, 9 to 5, and Saturdays during the semester from 11 to 3.
And Deborah Hughes, I know the Susan B. Anthony House and Museum is a wonderful treasure here. What do you want the public to know about it?
Well, I think the most important thing is Susan B. Anthony said when she died, pass by and get on with the work, and I think her vision was that we could become an amazing democracy for the world, and when we could achieve human rights for all, we will have achieved what she had hoped for.
When can we come see the House and Museum?
11 to 5, every day but Monday.
Chuck wrote on Twitter a picture of an I voted sticker on Susan B. Anthony's grave, and he said, I gave it to someone who deserved it more than I did. I think Susan B. Anthony would probably argue that we all just deserve it the same, Chuck. And that's what she always wanted, was just what everyone should deserve equally. I'll close with this. What does it mean to you to see people who go to her grave on a day like today?
People go with thanksgiving for those who've sacrificed and a commitment to continuing the work.
And you remain optimistic, determined? How do you feel?
Yeah, but you know, I was thinking, you mentioned Frederick Douglass. And Frederick Douglass and Susan B. Anthony disagreed on the 15th Amendment because he really said, we can't protect the rights of people if and very lives are at stake. So I see this as really important.
Thank you for the history lesson this hour on Susan B. Anthony's arrest in 1872 for voting, the trial in 1873, her refusal to pay the fine, the sexist reporting, and all that followed. And I think a great opportunity for us to get caught up on history that we knew little parts of, but we continue to learn more of. And I want to thank our guests for being here to help us understand our history on this election day. Deborah Hughes from the Susan B. Anthony House and Museum, always good. Thank you very much for being here.
And polls are open.
Polls are open. They are. Well, I think we know that. Autumn Haig, Special Collections Librarian and Archivist for Research and Collections at the University of Rochester River Campus Libraries. I love what you guys do. Thanks for sharing the stories with us.
Thank you.
Short break. More Connections coming up.